out. Are we here? Are we? Are we on the air? Oh, my goodness. Good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here. Mike Malloy on the Malloy Show. We've had quite a day here where it concerns getting 800 lines and roller lines and delay systems and blah, 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 blah. I can't even begin to tell you, so I won't even bother. But we have a new 800 number that I would like you to make note of, and we may even play with it a little bit tonight. I'm not sure yet. I'll let you know. The number is 877-99-MALLOY. Hey, how about that? 877-99-MALLOY. That's our new number if you would like to call the program. But don't do it right now, because we are not ready for you to give us a call. I have a ways to go here before we open up the lines. And I've got to tell you, we had it's been a long time since I've been in business for myself. As a matter of fact, the last time was right around the time that Kathy and I met, which was about 15 years ago.
Well, let me think, Mike. We just celebrated our 12th wedding anniversary.
Oh, so before,
so
well, 14 years ago.
14 years ago.
14 years ago. And that was the last time I was in business, or we were in business for ourselves, or I was, and said to Kathy back then, hey, watch, well, I work for someone else. Look at this. Well, that was an interesting situation developed out of that. But that was the last time I ever had to deal with getting phone lines put in. And AT&T has really gone right down the toilet since then. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's staggering how bad the service is. Just mind-boggling. What? The lines are all going dead?
I would have thought that 10% unemployment would have.
No,
better
no.
Customer service.
Not at all. And it's horrifying. Just horrifying. The 800 service that we got, AT&T wanted, I don't know what the hell they wanted, but we decided no. So I want to thank somebody. Nancy is her name, and everyone else at this company that we found online is called it's called Now 800. Now800.com. Now800.com. If you have a business, if you're thinking about getting Watts line, what do they call them now? Just 800 numbers, incoming lines. Try this company. I'm serious. Do they advertise with us? No. Have we asked them to? No. It's not about that. It's about a company that came through for us today that was just incredible. So, again, many thanks to Nancy and everyone else at now800.com. And if you're looking for 800 service, check them out, now800.com. And again, write it down for future reference. Our 800 number now is 877-99-MALLOY. 877-99-MALLOY. That's with two L's. A lot of weirdness. Weirdness just prevails. It gets weirder and weirder. The stock market went up again today by what, 3 points? Did we get an email today from Prairie 2 for our business report? I don't think we did. Where in the hell is Prairie 2? Let me look through here. How am I going to give you a economic update if our correspondent doesn't come through for us? We're going to have to dock his pay. Right? But anyway, a weird day, and not just at the Malloy compound getting all of this equipment together, but I'm talking about in the real world. The real world, where the story that what's his name Hirsch has out there I guess he's going to be in New Yorker. He hasn't written it yet, but he talked about it at a University of Minnesota gathering. He told an audience, Seymour Hirsch. He dropped a bombshell about Dick Cheney. We'll get to that in a little bit tonight. You may already know about it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff. Email from Dave in San Mateo, who writes, the subject line is, where's my 6-inch spike? Mike, looking forward to your new audio stream and podcast. If For your information, I need to let you know that while I appreciate immensely your perspectives on the economy and the death of capitalism, by hour two of the past few shows, I've had to tune out. Otherwise, I might have had to drive that spike into my thigh. Can we please take a break? Let's hear more about cancer clusters, environmental destruction, and death. You know, to lighten things up a bit. Regards, Dave. Now, I don't know what Dave's trying to tell me. I'll just take it at face value. I mean, it sounds like, he's being ironic. But on the other hand, maybe what we've been doing for the past four or five nights or week has been crushingly boring. I'm not sure. I've been focusing on this, the death of capitalism for the simple reason that this is, is there another story out there right now? I realize there are several critically important events that are occurring. It's almost like time has stopped and everything has kind of crashed into each other, and Barack Obama is trying to handle it, trying to handle it all. But there's so much that just needs our attention right now, and we can't do that. Obviously, you can't, I can't, the President of the United States can't. The Limbaugh Party, all they can do is stand there and say things like, "Well, this is earmarks." Oh, Jesus Christ! I wish they would just go away. Is there any chance, maybe, that somebody out there could get them to commit mass suicide? Is there any way that can happen? That the entire Limbaugh Party in the House and the Senate would just sit down over a huge vat of don't know, Jell-O flavored cyanide and just drink up, boys. Seriously, just drink up. You are so useless. But I digress. There's a lot of things going on. But the thing that the subject that we felt was necessary to focus on, to the best of my ability, is this economic situation. And again, if you've been hanging out with this program for a long time, you know that I very seldom have guests. Yeah, I could get experts and interviews and this and that and this and that. But, you know, that's what Hartman does. That's what Nancy Skinner does. That's what a lot of people do. They get the experts and they get down into the questions. And that's good. Yeah, that's good radio. You know, I'd love to listen to that kind of radio. But that's, you know, it's just not what I do. So I sit here and just go on and on and, you know, pick stories, pick reports, pick stuff off wires all over the country, off the net, yada, 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 and try to bring it together and make a little sense out of it. And the reason I don't do it with experts is because how often do you have an expert? I mean, how often do I have an expert? I don't have an expert. I got to figure this stuff out on my own, just like you do. You know, I can't. It's kind of a false reality. You turn into a radio program, and there's the host sitting there with an expert from the University of wherever, or this or that economic council, and yeah, okay, those are great questions and great answers, but Jesus God, I don't deal in that world, and I don't. Do you? So if it's good information you're looking for, Hartman, you know, Nancy, go for it. If the program you're looking for is one where we sit here and try to figure it out and don't use experts, because, you know, you don't carry an expert in your pocket or the back seat of your car. You just don't. So that's the reason, our San Mateo listener, that we've been focusing on this stuff. And the fact that, you know, in my opinion, capitalism is dead. It's just a matter of when it gets kicked to the curb. And because of the phone situation here for the past week, you know, it has been just an on and on and on monologue. And I know that can be exceedingly boring. You know, it'll make you insane to do that. But anyway, we'll be back after the break. And we're going to try the phones later on this evening. We'll see what happens. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It's been 10 long years since they locked me up.
liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
And soon it will render that frozen concoction that helps me hang on. Wasting away again in Margaritaville. Searching for my lost sugar salt.
It's about 22 past the hour. I was just looking at this, this story, of this quick note that's out there at Huffington Post now, that Michael Steele, the uncle who is the head of the Republican Party, right? African-American Michael Steele, that seems to feel that everything he has to say now is got to be run by the head of the Republican Party. He's the head of the Republican National Committee, but the head of the Republican Party is Rush Limbaugh. So Steele, you know, he apologizes, as all Republicans do, before Jabba the Hutt. That's why we don't call them Republicans anymore. We call them Limbots. But Michael Steele was being interviewed by GQ's Lisa DiPaolo. And you got to hear this. This is the key passage. Lisa, how much of your pro-life stance for you is informed not just by your Catholic faith, but by the fact that you were adopted? Michael Steele. Oh, a lot. Absolutely. I see the power of life in that. I mean, and the power of choice. The thing to keep in mind about it, you know, I think as a country we get off on these misguided conversations that throw around terms that really misrepresent truth. Lisa, explain that. Michael. The choice issue cuts two ways. You can choose life or you can choose abortion. You know, my mother chose life. So I think the power of the argument of choice boils down to stating a case for one or the other. Lisa, are you saying that you think women have the right to choose abortion? Michael Steele, yeah. I mean, again, I think that's an individual choice. Lisa, you do? Michael, yeah, absolutely. Well, isn't that interesting? Michael Steele is acknowledging the fact that women have a right to privacy. Again, it's not a matter of choosing abortion. It's a right to privacy in the confines of a conversation between a woman and her physician. So apparently Michael Steele, let's see how quickly this uncle jumps out now and says, whoa, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I didn't mean that. Let's see if the real head of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, gets on his ass tomorrow, gets on Michael Steele's ass, and whips him like he's been whipping this guy, like a character out of a slave the novel from the slave period in this country. It's really embarrassing. It must be awful to be Michael Steele. Here you are, the first African American to head the Republican Party, and it doesn't make any difference if you're figurehead or not. You are the titular head of the Republican National Committee. You're the man. And you have to debase yourself and grovel in front of this great, giant, white, fat white man, because he decides to take you, the head of the Republican National Committee, to the woodshed and whip your ass. So then you have to go publicly, and for a black man to do that in front of this large, ugly white man, like deja vu. I mean, wow, Michael Steele must really want that job. But now he's come out and said what he said. Yeah, women have a right to choose an abortion. Women have a right, what that means, women have a right to privacy. Interesting. Well, let's see what happens, right? Mike, this email says, my name is Ronnie. The other night you mentioned something about Chuck Norris and his comments about small cells forming. And the fools who call themselves patriots and all that BS. I also saw the link you posted for the video with the Marine chanting for Republic and defending the Constitution. This is a message to any of those so-called patriots out there. Stop your blank BS. Only he uses the word. If you are the patriot you say you are, why don't you fight to prosecute Bush and his cabinet? They're the ones who took away your freedom. They're the ones who sent Blackwater mercenaries to confiscate the guns in New Orleans, and you call yourselves a patriot? You are jackass cowards. Bush stepped on the Constitution, got away with treason and murder. What are you going to do, patriot? well done, Ronnie. I mean, couldn't say it better. Yeah, that really irritated the hell out of me, too. Patriot, my ass. Now, where's that other thing I wanted to share with you? Well, there's a break coming, so I'll find it. There's a couple of stories floating around here that involve the military and the CIA that are positively, absolutely bizarre. We'll share them with you as soon as we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Redefining anger management. It's Mike Malloy.
Redefining anger management. Yeah, okay. It's about 25 before the hour. A couple of stories that I'm not sure how to process this stuff. First. The report that the ACLU is, Rachel Oswald wrote this, and I think this also is from, the website that Larissa Alexandrovna writes for, Raw Story. Man, my brain is not working tonight. It just isn't. This has been a very, very difficult day to get things done. But Rachel Oswald, also writing at rawstory.com, writes about how the ACLU is angry that a military judge has accepted what she refers to as an incendiary legal pleading filed by those five 9/11 suspects, despite President Obama's order stopping the Guantanamo Military Commission from conducting hearings, and even though attorneys for some of those defendants were unaware that this filing was being made. Now, we talked about this last night. We took the charges that were in the filing by the five defendants at face value. What they said in the filing, again, face value. We're going to go beneath the surface here in just a second. But we took it all at face value. I took it all at face value and said, okay, when they accuse us of being the greatest terrorist organization on earth, are they right? In my opinion, they're close to being right. We're the only country who's ever used nuclear weapons against civilians. We did our killing and destabilizing all over the earth for the past 50 years without let up. So, and the death toll from the policies of the U.S. foreign policy, the death toll is staggering. It's in the millions. And this was all done in the name of capitalism. It was not done in the name of preserving the freedom of the people of the United States. I mean, come on, at least, even your right-wingers, at least for Christ's sake, be honest. If you need to be brainwashed, if you need to be a limbot, okay, is there any chance you can be a little bit honest? I guess not. I guess that the one precludes the other, so okay. But that's who we are. The United States is, I think that's one of the reasons a lot of people like to come here, is because they know that we have an economic system that, the capitalist system, that allows pretty much anyone to do anything with no restrictions, no holdbacks, nothing. And look where that got us. And we have a foreign policy that dictates we are going to rip and destroy anyone we want to rip and destroy, whether it's right up front, like invading Iraq twice, or if it's clandestine operations like overthrowing the government of Iran, or overthrowing the government of Guatemala, overthrowing the government of South Vietnam. Need I go on? It's just, anyone who gets in the way of the United States gets murdered, gets killed, gets their country ripped to pieces. That's the way it's been. Now, obviously, it's starting to change because we are losing our superpower status. There's a new dog in the kennel, and it speaks Chinese. So, things are probably going to change. But having said all that, these five defendants went on and said things, very incendiary things. We can't wait. We're glad 3,000 people died in the United States. We're glad the bombing occurred. Praise Allah. Praise the Quran. Praise blah, blah, blah. On and on and on and on. And again, we took it at face value. But hold on just a second. Hold on just a second. First of all, there's the question, and Larissa raised this at her blog, at largely.com. She says, hold on a second, we're being spoon-fed stupid again. She says, can someone explain to me how five suspected members of Al-Qaeda suddenly got their own PR machine from inside Gitmo and into the hands of a military judge, not to mention getting a world stage through which to frighten Americans some more and the media? Well, they are too well-versed in stupid to ask any sensible questions, but here goes. Five Guantanamo prisoners accused of September 11, 2001 terror attacks on the U.S. staunchly defended their actions, calling the operation blessed and great, and the accusations against them badges of honor. Remember we talked about this last night? The five said in their filing in response this month to the U.S. government's war crimes charges against them, they said, you are the last nation that has the right to speak about civilians and killing civilians. They also said, and we talked about this last night, you are professional criminals with all the means the words carry. Therefore, we will treat you the same. We will attack you just like you have attacked us. And whomever initiated the attacks is the guilty party. And it goes on. That it was a six-page response. We just skimmed across the highlights last night, the real incendiary parts. But the response includes input from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, according to the CIA, plotted the attacks, and four others. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, according to this filing, admits he plotted the attacks, but during his torture sessions, he also admitted, according to people who seemed to know, perhaps they were there, perhaps they looked at the transcripts, he confessed to everything. Things that it would have been physically impossible for him to even been on the same continent as they were occurring, much less had a hand in actually carrying out these actions. But I guess when one is being tortured in the manner in which that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed apparently was tortured, you are going to confess to anything. Like we mentioned the other night, and I think I had the wrong time, but it took 17 seconds to get big old Christopher Hitchens to cry uncle and make it stop. Just waterboarding. So, Larissa has some questions, and she would like someone to explain the following to her. Here's one. How did five alleged Al-Qaeda members come together to form the statement, given that they're being held each in isolation at Gitmo? Are they allowed to meet and discuss various topics, including their alleged joy at bombing the United States? Larissa writes, somehow I don't think so. We know that some of their own attorneys were not even aware of this filing or what it said. So was this done telepathically? Two. And how is it that this filing was accepted by the court when some of the attorneys for the five men were not even aware that such a thing was going to be filed? And she quotes this, the ACLU is angry that a military judge has accepted this filing, even though the attorneys for some of the defendants were unaware of it. And then Larissa says, now stay with me here. Five alleged Al-Qaeda members issue a statement of guilt, an incendiary statement, rejoicing at the lost American lives of those attacks 7 years ago. through a filing with the court. This filing is accepted by the court despite some of the attorneys not being aware that this is going to be filed or what was going to be declared on behalf of their clients. Moreover, defying President Obama's ruling putting a halt on all Gitmo military commissions, the judge in the case not only accepted the filing, but also released it to the public. Does anyone else find this all just a bit too well-timed, not to mention idiotic? Seriously, what purpose could this serve in helping the American cause or in keeping the nation safe? She says, I think we are witnessing the military-industrial complex defying the President of the United States and using the attacks of 9/11 to upset the public and gain support for their own objectives. The media has spent all day, she was referring to, was it yesterday, the day before? The media has spent all day rehashing this, calling in military experts to decipher the minds of the accused without once asking the two obvious questions, how and why. How did these five men discuss and approve this statement, if some of their attorneys were not even aware of it? And why did the court happen to accept this filing, given the above issue? Why did the court decide to release this to the public despite years of secrecy on everything else, including denying access to something as basic as current photographs of these accused men? Why is this being released now? How does it benefit anyone to release this to the public? It only benefits one group of people, the military defense establishment, the military and defense establishment. Yeah, the military and its defense contractors, that terribly incestuous pool of corruption, are playing scare the foolish American people again in public and for the world to see in order to frighten us to bend to its will. The only problem, per the usual, is that they are too wrapped in stupidity to actually pull it off, even with such a compliant fourth estate. Some of us actually still rely on reason and logic, common sense even. And then she goes on. She goes on, and then she says, but I digress. She said, we have detained these men for years, refusing to release even a picture of them to the public, claiming that national security reasons override the rule of law. And then, as if by magic, and as Obama moves to cut off the military-industrial feeding trough, all of a sudden, all five detainees admit their guilt. And wait, the kicker is not only do the five admit their guilt, but they sing it with joy. So something's going on. We'll talk about it in a minute. Stay with us.
They woke up level meetings at undisclosed locations to suspend the Constitution and sustain the corporation. Their minutes, notes, and memos can't be shared. And by the way, does anybody know the current whereabouts? Oh, it's national security, above the public scrutiny, policy of legal coup d'etat. Oh, we have a shadow government. Imagine that.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
It's about 10 before the hour. So, you know, when I was going over that story last night on the program, the careful wording of this filing, the noun and verb in agreement, the proper tenses being used. Rhetoric that I mean, just sound a little bit more than a little bit polished. The kind of rhetoric that you and I would respond to, or the hope that Americans would respond to by saying, "Wait a goddamn minute," you know, that sort of thing. But when you look at the actual charges, the counter charges that these five defendants allegedly leveled against it. Now, let me pause for a second. I'm not suggesting here, like Larissa mentioned this too, I'm not suggesting that these people didn't have anything to do with what occurred on September 11th. I mean, who knows? The Bush-Cheney crime family has so corrupted the legal process, we'll never know. We'll never know what really happened. The only thing we have to go on is the torture evidence. That's all. We shall never know what really happened. And this was the plan, in my opinion. Was there a plan? You're goddamn right there was a plan. The plan was to leave everything so messy, leave the crime scene so messy, that nobody could sort it out. And part of that leaving the crime scene was the 9/11 Commission, which made about as much sense as a ball of string after your kitten has got a hold of it. There was no sense to anything that was in the 9/11 Commission report. This whole thing, everything points, in my opinion, points to complicity, some level, made it happen, let it happen, ignored the intelligence, you know, it's gotten so confusing. Who in the hell will ever sort it out? And it's also divided America. On the one side, we have people to say, look, those sons of bitches made that happen to this country. On the other side, you have people say, no, it was just poor intelligence. It was just poor intelligence. 19 guys with box cutters slipped through whatever security is set up for the most destructive nation in the history of the human race and somehow managed to do this. Well, okay. I'm not going to rehash the 9/11 stuff on tonight's program. We will at some point. We'll get back to it. But since that event occurred, the main function of the Bush crime family is to destroy evidence the best they can. Now, how do you destroy evidence? You can't, uncollapse the trade towers. You can't bomb the Pentagon. You can't bring 3,000 people back to life. How do you destroy the evidence? You corrupt everything. Corrupt the crime scene, which they did, and then mush everything up. Get people. How to say this? Arrest people, charge them with this stuff, and then hold them and torture them in a manner, and hold them forever. That was the thing about forever detention. They never had to be brought to trial. They never had to be confronted with the evidence against them. They never would have a chance to refute the evidence. They never would be able to talk to an attorney in private. None of it held. And how is that justified? Well, that kind of stuff doesn't work when it's offshore. It's not offshore. The United States, that's U.S. property at Guantanamo by virtue of the fact that we have a forever lease. But this is what these son of a bitches did. And then they bring in pigs like John Yoo and half-asses like Alberto Gonzalez and David Addington and all these people who write these phony legal memos that say, yeah, well, you can go ahead and do that, Mr. Bush. You can go ahead and do that, Mr. Cheney. I'll tell you what, maybe John Yoo could write me a letter that says I can walk into the local Bank America here in Atlanta and take all the money. Would that be okay, you dumb bastards? Ooh, calm down, Mike. But all of a sudden, out of all this confusion, and the realization on some real wizard's part in the military prosecution field, you cannot convict these people based on their testimony. It's testimony that came under torture. And there are no, who's going to witness against them? CIA officers? So what do? You produce a document allegedly put together by these five people, signed by them, presented to the court by them, with no input from their attorneys, nothing. And why make this filing any different from anything else that's happened to these people? Attorney? Are you kidding? Examination of the charges against them? Get real. Constitutional protections? What the hell are you talking about? So, here it comes. A five-page filing that is written in the kind of language that you would expect a propagandist to write in. An educated propagandist who understands clearly the hot buttons for the American public. Huh? And why do you want to do that? Why do that? Why present a document like this to a court after the President of the United States has ordered all this stuff to cease? Is it a shot across Barack Obama's bow by the military-industrial complex that the Eisenhower warned against so clearly and deliberately 55 years ago? Is it the so-called defense industry, the weapons industry, the death industry in this country who sees, you know, times are tough right now, and it looks like Barack Obama's already talking about canceling this weapon system and putting that one on hold. Jesus Christ, we can't have that happen. I mean, we are the biggest exporters of death machines on earth. We are. That's what we export. We don't export cars and textiles and shoes and drop forges and machinery and steel anymore. We export efficient ways to deliver death, individual death or mass death. And if somebody's going to pull the plug or tamper with that exportation of death, hadn't we ought to let him or her know that we're not going to stand for it, right, if we're the defense industry? What in the hell do you suppose is going on, Truesigger? Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. So, again, Rachel Oswald, writing at rawstory.com, points out that the judge in the Guantanamo detainee case who accepted this filing from the five detainees, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four of his accomplices, The judge seems to be acting in a deliberate contravention of the orders from Barack Obama, doesn't he? According to Anthony Romero, who's the executive director of the ACLU, in a release statement, Romero said, quote, Judge Henley apparently doesn't know what the word halt means, since he has blatantly defied President Obama's executive order for an end to the military commissions. The judge's actions extending the military commissions call into question the true intentions of the Pentagon leadership. At a time when the Obama administration is searching for a solution to the disastrous detention policies of the Bush administration, end quote. And then Anthony Romero adds, quote, if Defense Secretary Gates allowed the military commissions to proceed, that's a serious problem. If he didn't know about it, that's equally troubling. Moreover, to selectively release a filing that clearly serves the objectives of the prosecution when defense motions have regularly been suppressed raises the suspicion that political motivations are at play. End quote. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And maybe more than just political motivations. Right, Anthony? The Associated Press writes that the pleading from these five guys was, quote, submitted to the Guantanamo War Crimes Court and released by the Pentagon in English over the objections of attorneys for two of the men. The five had previously said they wanted to plead guilty to the charges against them, but this is their most detailed response yet, end quote. Now, what does it mean to the Obama administration? This happened, what, Monday? Tuesday, all right, at the White House press briefing the other day, Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said, But the judge's decision to accept the detainee's legal pleading was not troubling. Gibbs was asked if the decision by the judge to accept the legal filings, given Obama's order that the military commission proceedings be halted, if that bothered him. Gibbs responded with no. The president, not unlike our dealings with Afghanistan and Pakistan, we've developed a process to review the status of those at Guantanamo and determine how best to deal with individual detainees and how to bring those that committed horrible acts to justice, and that continues as well. End quote. Robert Gibbs. So what do you think? Do you think that that answer from Gibbs was a straight-up answer? Or has word gone out, much as it did with Kennedy? And, of course, Kennedy ignored everything. When John Fitzgerald Kennedy decided to go against the military industrial complex that his immediate predecessor had just warned the country about, when Kennedy decided that the Bay of Pigs invasion was nonsense and shouldn't happen, it went ahead anyway, of course, because the planning was so far ahead, and Kennedy did not have the mechanism other than executive order to stop it. When it came time to get involved in the Vietnamese Civil War, and Kennedy didn't want to, and all of a sudden, history says that Kennedy ordered the assassination of Diem, the Ngo Dinh Diem, the leader of South Vietnam, just, was it weeks, months before Kennedy himself was shot? Is it possible that, and I think it's not possible, it's highly probable, that the military industrial establishment, not some, you know, group of Rosicrucians or trilateral commissions or any of that nonsense, but just some American industrialists, the same ilk who tried to overthrow the government of FDR. Don't forget, there was an armed insurrection being planned by by capitalists in this country when we were in the Great Depression, and to establish fascism. You know who is involved. Come on, don't pretend like you don't. Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and just on and on. E.I. DuPont, on and on. So Kennedy, when Kennedy was told, look, here's how it works. Don't tamper with it. And he tampered with it. They shot him. Oh, I know. It's Lee Harvey Oswald. Right, okay. So is there a possibility that Barack Obama, I mean, look what he's done since he came into power. Well, I know he's done a couple of things that you and I, being good liberals that we are, we're pissed off about, and we're scratching our noggins and going, well, what does that mean? I don't know what it means. Maybe it means that Barack Obama doesn't want to be assassinated by the very same type of people that assassinated John F. Kennedy and threatened to get FDR. Huh? You think? I don't know. I mean, is this way out in left field? Probably. Wild speculation by a crazed radio talk show host. So let's hope. So that would explain, though, why Robert Gibbs at the press briefing, I think it was yesterday, said, no, we're perfectly okay with the fact that this judge decided to give the President of the United States the middle finger. We're okay. No problem. Hey, you know, we'll get there. We've got to figure out how best, to deal with individual detainees and how to bring those that did commit horrible acts to justice. And, you know, we're working on it. So we're okay with the judge utterly and absolutely defying the President of the United States. No problem. Why? Did you think we would have a problem? Is that what happened? Is it? Now, the other story that really rang my chimes today. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, day before yesterday, was at the University of Minnesota giving a speech, and almost inadvertently, almost out of context, he told an audience that the U.S. military was running, quote, an executive assassination ring, end quote, throughout the Bush years, which reported directly to Dick Cheney. Now, again, as reported at rawstory.com, Muriel Cain wrote this one. The remark came out seemingly inadvertently when Seymour Hersh was asked by the moderator of a public discussion of, quote, America's constitutional crisis, end quote. Hersh was asked whether abuses of executive power, like those that occurred under Nixon, continue to this day. Hersh replied, quote, now, before I go on, you know who Seymour Hersh is. Surely you do. Investigative reporter, right? He used to write for the New York Times, writes for the New Yorker magazine. He was the one to expose the original story on the My Lai, and so much more. I hate to go back to the 70s on that one, but if you don't know Seymour Hersh, for God's sake, just do a Google on him. H-E-R-S-H, Seymour Hersh. Anyway. Hersh then went on, he explained, after 9/11, I haven't written about this yet, but after 9/11, the CIA was very deeply involved in domestic activities against people they thought to be enemies of the state, without any legal authority, and they haven't been called on it yet. And then Hersh went on to describe a second area of extra-legal operations, the Joint Special Operations Command. The Joint Special Operations Command. Do you know what that is? We'll talk about it when I come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Show. You are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
It's about 21 past the hour. All right, Seymour Hersh sitting on a panel at the University of Minnesota, said that the military was running an executive assassination ring throughout the Bush years, which reported directly to Cheney. Hersh went on to describe a second area of extra-legal operations, the so-called Joint Special Operations Command. Hersh said, quote, it is a special wing of our special operations community that is set up independently. They do not report to anybody. Except in the Bush-Cheney days, they reported directly to Cheney. Congress has no oversight. He goes on. It's an executive assassination ring, essentially. And it's been going on and on and on. Under President Bush's authority, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on in the name of all of us. End quote. Hersh, after this meeting at the University of Minnesota, told MinPost.com blogger Eric Black in an email exchange after the event that this subject was, quote, not something I wanted to dwell about in public, end quote. He is looking into all this, Hersh says, for a book, but he believes it may be a year or two before he has enough evidence, quote, for even the most skeptical. Really, end quote. And then as Muriel Kane writes at Raw Story, stories have been coming out about covert Pentagon assassination squads for the last several years. In 2003, Hirsch himself reported on Task Force 121, which operated chiefly out of the Joint Special Operations Command. Other stories spoke of a proposed proactive preemptive operations group. And as Hirsch noted in Minnesota, the New York Times just a few days ago described the Joint Special Operations Command as overseeing the secret commando units in Afghanistan, whose missions were temporarily ordered halted last month because of growing concerns over excessive civilian deaths. However, it appears that Hirsch is now on the trail of some fresh revelation about these squads and their connection to Cheney that goes well beyond anything that has previously been reported. Well, that certainly leaves me with an unpleasant feeling in the pit of my stomach. I mean, it's not surprising. We've been saying for 7 years, 8 years, that Cheney is a killer, that he's totally amoral. And whatever involvement he would have with torture or death squads, it would be deep and abiding. That's just who he is. You know, the involvement of Dick Cheney and all of these people that were in such positions of power, overt and covert during the Bush-Cheney years, all of them had been involved in death on a scale of civilian death. I'm not necessarily talking about political assassinations per se, but death on a scale that, while not up with Hitler or Stalin, for the people in the countries that they were involved in, it was horrifying. Hundreds of thousands of people dead in Central America during the Reagan years. What's the estimate on Vietnam? 2 or 3 million people dead in North and South Vietnam. More than that? Cambodia. There'll never be an answer for those numbers. And it goes on and on and on. And they wound up in the Bush crime family, the people who not only carried out the slaughter, but the people who organized it, wrote it down, figured out the planning, got the money. The Boland Amendment that was written specifically to deny funds to secret operations in Central America was bypassed when people like General John Singlaub and Colonel Oliver North and Admiral John Poindexter, when they decided, you know, screw this, we will sell weapons to our enemies. We will sell TOW missiles to the Iranians, and we will use an Israeli broker as the middleman, and we will take the money that we make in selling these TOW missiles to the Iranians, and we will use this money to kill people in Central America. I mean, the darkest, craziest stuff you can possibly imagine. But, of course, this is not the time to focus on that, right? Because we are suffering this massive financial breakdown and a collapse of capitalism. So the murder and the death and the mayhem that nobody seems to, in positions that could do this, no one seems to really want to investigate. Not Barack Obama and not the generally recognized power establishment in this country, certainly not the news media in any form, with possible exception to someone like Seymour Hersh. So I don't know. It's disturbing. If you want to get in on this, give me a call right now, 877-99-MALLOY.
He didn't even say goodbye. He didn't take the time to lie. Bang, bang. He shot me down, bang, bang. I hit the ground, bang, bang. That awful sound, bang, bang. My baby shot me down.
Ease the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Okay, let's see if our phone system works. Mark is calling from Richmond, Virginia, listening on Sirius. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm cool. I'm good. How are you?
I've seen better days, you know. But
I hear that.
Yeah, I was telling her a minute ago when she was picked up my call that I thought this, on the surface, this feels a little bit crazy to think, but then again, what doesn't? You mentioned before the last break that maybe that certain atrocities were being investigated due to the financial crisis, and I completely agree with that.
Uh-huh.
Could it be, and this is where I feel crazy, that perhaps things were allowed to happen as a diversion, as a tactic to, I guess a better way of putting it would be, you know, if you're, you know,
yeah, I think I know where you're going with it, Mark. And listen, your call is coming through awful. I realize you're on a cell phone and you're probably driving, but I think I get the gist of what you're saying, and appreciate it. Thanks for checking in, Mark. Diversion. That is the point, I think, of a lot of people in the so-called 9/11 community, people who don't say the Bush crime family was physically, hands-on, complicit in the attack on this country, but that they were complicit in the fact that they let it happen. There's two schools of thought, made it happen, let it happen. I don't see that much difference. I think it's completely understood that because of our policies in the Middle East for the past 60 years, we have built up an enormous force of enemies out there. Just about every Arab-speaking nation, and some that don't speak Arabic, that are not oil producers, and some that are oil producers, would like to see the United States turn into a smoking crater, because we have disrespected their culture and their religion. And, you know, it's not for me to say whether their culture or their religion deserves disrespect, except in the context that I say all religion sucks, frankly. But as a diversion, setting up the events of 9/11 by reading the intelligence and then just turning the other way. I mean, that's all it would take, right? Getting the intelligence, like Bush said to the low-ranking intelligence officer who brought him that warning, and Bush said, okay, you can go now, you've covered your ass. I mean, what a flippant statement. Coming from Bush, it was probably just that, a flippant statement. But to the people who manipulated Bush, and he was willing to be manipulated, I'm not trying to paint him as a Ronald Reagan, in that regard. But to the people who manipulated Bush, this was it. Here it was. You know, don't forget what the Project for the New American Century had said years before, after they had attempted to get Clinton to launch an invasion against a couple of countries in the Middle East, and he said no, or not the Middle East, South Asia, and he said no. Their whole scam was that this country needed another Pearl Harbor in order to forward their agenda. Now, a lot of people think the agenda was simply the shoring up of the Israeli military, that if the United States were attacked, this would deep six any efforts on the part of the U.S. diplomatic establishment or military establishment to try to deal with the Palestinians or the Syrians or the Iranians, or the Iraqis, on some level other than murder, intimidation, slaughter, bombing, so on and so forth. So, if you want to really take a look at the situation and just step outside the parameters that we've all been conditioned to believe, I mean, if you've got the interest in doing that, you can do it. And just take a look at the situation. Was the attack on this country, September 11th, specifically as a diversionary tactic to, A, give to the Bush administration supreme power to do whatever they wanted to do, but most importantly, supreme power not to send people into the detention camps here, but to rob the entire world blind? Yeah, let's have an attack. Let's respond with some half-assed bombing of Afghanistan, and then we'll make the real move, the one that we, the neocons, have always wanted, a direct invasion of Iraq, which will give us military bases there, so that if Syria or Saudi Arabia eventually, or Kuwait, or Libya, or any of these countries ever feel froggy and start to jump towards Israel, then we have a fully equipped military operation already in the Middle East. So, you know, take your pick. There's a whole menu of stuff there. But maybe it was none of that. Or maybe that stuff was just afterthought. Maybe the real reason was what we're talking about here. Create a diversion. An attack on this country. 3,000 people die. Yawn. Who cares? Who cares? 3,000 people dead. All right. Go ahead. Get it over with. And let's get to the business. The real business of what this attack's all about. And that is stealing the U.S. Treasury blind, making the rules the cancellation of the Glass-Steagall Act back in 96-97, making that all of a sudden extremely profitable for the international predators who were now going to steal everything, every goddamn thing that they could get their hands on and stuff they couldn't get their and nobody's going to pay attention because, after all, we're at war, and Bush is handing out directives that say if anybody does anything, that'll be considered an act that can cause you to lose your freedom. We can arrest you. We can detain you. We can hold you without charges. Look, we're doing it here. We're doing it there. Look what we're doing over in Iraq. We're torturing people. Look what, and putting leashes around their necks. Look what we're doing down in Guantanamo. Look what we're doing on Diego Garcia. Look what we're doing all over the world. So shut up, Americans. Just stand perfectly still. We're going to take everything you've got and everything you might have for the next 50 years. This has been the plan for a long time. Ooh. Really? Nah. Not an Ice Cube's chance in hell. Come on, Mike. That is so over the top. That is so incredibly bizarre. You're starting to sound like a buffoon on your own program. Yeah, okay. Okay. That's cool. But it is an idea, isn't it? Death squads that answered only to Dick Cheney. Well, if anything happens to Seymour Hersh in the next year or two, as he is writing a book about this, that will possibly confirm it. You know, the military establishment in this country has been pissed off at Seymour Hersh ever since he revealed My Lai. Which is not to say that the military establishment in this country was in favor of the wholesale slaughter and execution of civilians in Vietnam. Because I don't think the entirety of the military establishment were. Were there some crazy people in charge during our occupation, invasion, and death trip in Vietnam? Sure, of course there were. Of course there were. A number of them, General William Westmoreland being the number one murderer, psychopathic son of a bitch where it concerned Vietnam. But they weren't all that way. They couldn't have been. I don't think we have produced a race of Genghis Khan-like warriors who don't care about human life. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. That was a long time ago. That's 40 years ago, right? 40 years ago. Who knows? Who knows what was going on with some of those horrific operations where civilians were being mowed down. But I'm talking about the entire military establishment, the upper ranks. I don't think that they were necessarily willing to murder civilians. I don't think that the upper ranks of the U.S. military now is willing to commit this kind of murder. But somebody like Dick Cheney and his cohorts inside the military, don't forget, Cheney was a coward. Cheney had 4, 5, 6 deferments to stay out of the military. Cheney famously told the Washington Post, I had better things to do during the 60s than get involved with the military. So I don't know. I don't know why the why any aspect of the military you want to pick, once Cheney approached him with something like this, why they didn't take him out someplace and allow him to have a hunting accident. I don't understand. I don't know what to think anymore, do you?
And a ribbon on your mailbox with the stars of ours. Do you support the president and the war for oil? Do you think the sun's the law there on someone else's soil? How far is it from here to Nuremberg? Did you hear about Fallujah and 100,000 dead? Did you hear about the torture in the newspapers you read? Did you pretend it didn't matter? Did you blame a few bad men?
Talk radio right from the left. It's More Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. So I was just looking at some stuff here. January 26, 1998, is a significant day for a couple of reasons. Here's the first one. On that day, the letter from the group known as PNAC, Project for a New American Century, on January 26, 1998, they sent the letter to Clinton asking him to invade Iraq. Removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power now needs to become the aim of American foreign policy, this letter said. It goes on, we urge you to articulate this aim and to turn your administration's attention to implementing a strategy for removing Saddam's regime from power. This will require a full complement of diplomatic, political, and military efforts. Although we are fully aware of the dangers and difficulties in implementing this policy, blah, 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 blah. And then it closes by saying, we urge you to act decisively. If you act now to end the threat of weapons of mass destruction against the United States or its allies, you will be acting in the most fundamental national security interests of the country. If we accept a course of weakness and drift, we put our interests and our future at risk. And then this letter, of course, it's much longer than that. The letter is signed by Elliot Abrams, one of the convicted Iran-Contra conspirators, Richard Armitage, who pretty much anyone who has studied the so-called CIA wet work in Vietnam, hands-on murder, know he was involved in it, William Bennett, you know who he is, he's all over television now, Jeffrey Bergner, John Bolton, the crazed son of a bitch that got a recess appointment to be our UN ambassador, Paula Dobriansky, Francis Fukuyama, you know him, Robert Kagan, you know him, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is now an ambassador, he's the ambassador to Iraq now, isn't he? William Kristol, the psychopath who also wrote for a while for New York Times, Richard Perle, there's his name again, Peter Rodman, Donald Rumsfeld, William Schneider, Vin Weber, Paul Wolfowitz, Robert Zelick, and R. James Woolsey. These are the people who signed the letter for the Project of the New American Century on January 26, 1998. Now, Clinton turned it down. What happened on January? The month of January was pretty intense for Clinton because that's when the story of a possible sex relationship between Clinton and Monica Lewinsky started to get out there. And finally, on January 25th, 1998, the day before this letter was sent to Clinton, Lewinsky tells this special prosecutor, Ginsburg, this is before they had the psychopath, Ken Starr. Lewinsky tells Ginsburg that she will tell all, or I'm sorry, yeah, Lewinsky, according to Ginsburg, says she will tell all in exchange for immunity. Clinton political advisor James Carville says, quote, a war will be waged between Clinton supporters and Kenneth Starr over Starr's investigation tactics. And then on January 26, the very day this letter was written, is when Clinton said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. On the same day, Ginsburg offers Starr a summary of what Lewinsky is prepared to say to the grand jury in exchange for a grant of immunity from prosecution. Now, it's all coincidence, right? In the month of January, 1998, when the story is starting to build some power about Monica Lewinsky's non-sexual affair, okay, so they had a little hand job, I guess. That was how it came out in that piece of pornography that was Ken Starr's final report. But it certainly was nobody's business. I mean, we used to maintain that back in 98, 99, when it seemed like every program I did on WLS in Chicago had to do with this miserable, stinking situation that the trap that Clinton had allowed himself to get put into by the Republicans. But they gave him a way out, you see. They gave him a way out with this letter from PNAC. Look, buddy, all you have to do is invade Iraq. And the implication was all this other stuff will stop. Don't worry about it. Hey, and I'm sure somebody probably, they might not have told Clinton this, but somebody along the chain there in the PNAC said, well, if he does agree, we'll take Monica Lewinsky for a ride and they'll find her corpse maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now, or what remains of it. There'll be a few bones left that the animals haven't disturbed. But Clinton didn't go for it. He said no. And look what happened to Clinton. Now, is that true? Is that real? I mean, the dates are right there. The letter, January 26, 1998, from PNAC. Clinton forced into a perjury trap, January 26, 1998. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky, all on the same day. Now, idle speculation, right? Doesn't mean anything? Okay. Probably doesn't. But, makes you wonder when Barack Obama says, I want the military trials to stop in Guantanamo until we can sort all this mess out. And within 2 weeks of his saying that, a judge down there, a military judge, accepts a statement, a filing in the form of a statement by these five detainees who very articulately, pushing all the right buttons, says to the judge, no, we didn't. We're glad we did it. And the judge accepts the filing and releases it to the public in what appears to be obvious defiance of Bill Clinton, of Barack Obama. A day later, Barack Obama's press secretary says, well, no, we don't think that's out of line. Really? We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is just about 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. Thanks for tuning in. You're still here. Oh, good. All right, you know what we're talking about. We're going to go to talk to Dennis here in just a second, but two emails very quickly. One from William. Mike, don't you think that part of the reason that when the 9/11 attack happened, when the 9/11 attack happened, and you recall, most of the world was on our side offering to help find bin Laden. And remember, the Bush crime family tossed that offer in their faces just so we could perform these operations and build bases in Iraq on our own. If we had taken their offer, we probably never would have been in Iraq to begin with. It all seems part of the grand plan. Yeah, sure. And Art writes, Mike, while I was not necessarily a fan of his, don't you think that Elliot Spitzer found himself in the same dilemma that you just described regarding Clinton in 1998? If I recall, there was talk that Spitzer was on the trail of the Wall Streeters and the bankers before that story blew. Whenever someone is caught with their pants down, just look around to see who would benefit from the downfall. They are snakes. Art. Yeah, Spitzer was about to issue indictments, wasn't he, against some of these predators. But no, that didn't happen because we got all caught up in the fact that Spitzer was paying for sexual services. Good God. All right. Let's talk with Dennis, who is... still trying to figure out these buttons. All right, Dennis, listening on the internet near Sacramento. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
I've had occasion in my business career to deal with police detectives.
Uh-huh.
And when they're looking for a murder suspect, and the first thing they look for is the money trail.
Yeah, oh, sure.
And it usually is an insurance policy, you know, life insurance or some reason that somebody gets murdered. It's usually money behind it. And my question is to you, do you think, given the Bush crime family's history where they looted America, they looted the treasury, the middle class, through all the laws they passed, loosening up, deregulating credit card laws, everything, and making bankruptcy harder and all that. My question is for you. Do you think the Cheney bunch is still in charge? I mean, they ran up the oil price.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was set in 2001. It's still top secret, isn't it? Do you think they're still in charge of this hit squad?
The hit squad? Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that they're still exerting a pressure on people. The difference is once the administration is gone and there's a new administration, and that means a new commander in chief, if there is military operation or if there are military operations going on around the planet, then that commander in chief role, which is not the primary function of the president at all. The primary function of the president is to be calling the CEO. That commander in chief thing that has become so batted around in primaries. You want this person to be commander in chief? That was an afterthought. But okay, it's an afterthought. So we're in the situation. Two wars the Bush crime family initiated, and there might be a lot of people in the military right now who are not willing to continue to take orders from Cheney because if they are found out, they could get a general court-martial and some bad things could happen to them unless they are very clear in understanding that Cheney and Wolfowitz and Elliot Abrams and Negroponte and all these spooky, scary sons of bitches are still out there, as you suggest. And as soon as Obama does the wrong thing, Obama will be gone one way or the other. So I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it at all, Dennis.
Can I ask you one more thing?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
well, that's all right.
It was taken back, going back to what you said.
About continuing the hit squad or.
God dang it, I forgot what I was going to ask. Oh, well, never mind. I'll let you go.
All right. Well, if you think about it, you know, we can bring it up again. Dennis, thanks for checking.
I was on the subject of whether you know, it's just about this idea of stealing all the – oh, that was it. I'm sorry. I had a lost train of thought here. The idea that they've stolen trillions of dollars.
Yeah, that it was all diversion. Now, let's face it, a lot of that money.
All this money.
Yeah, a lot of it was on paper.
I know, but why? What? How much money do you freaking need?
I know.
What is their ultimate point? We have such a wonderful constitution, and you know, it's just a wonderful document, and it guarantees human rights and everything, and these guys, what the heck is going on here? What is your opinion?
All right, let me see if I can answer it on the air. Dennis, thanks for checking in. Call us again, all right?
Okay, take
care. All right, man, appreciate it. The only answer I can come up with, what's the point, would be the obvious quick answer, and that's greed, the kind of greed that is just unknown in the annals of history until these people came along, unless you go back to the mythology, like Midas. But and I don't mean the muffler shop, but I don't quite get it. Was it Thomas Friedman's column today in the New York Times talking about looting? No, it wasn't Friedman. It was who was it? Who had that column in today's? It's immaterial, but. This wasn't theft. This wasn't stealing. This was looting. This was emptying the treasuries of how many countries? Now, again, a lot of it was on paper. When you're dealing in debt, you're not dealing in real money, are you, Prairie 2? I mean, it's not real money. It's marks on a piece of paper, and everybody keeps score by those marks on a piece of paper. But, you know, when they talk about $30 trillion has disappeared globally. That doesn't mean that there were boxes and boxes and boxes of money and all of a sudden they're gone. Now, granted, that did happen in Iraq, but it only happened to a billion. there were pallets of money shipped to Iraq and it was stolen. Who knows where it went? And it was in the hundreds of millions, possibly billions. But as a diversion, so a smoke screen, a smoke bomb, the so-called war on terror, which is nonsense. It's first of all, it's I defy anyone to define the term. You can't make war on a tactic. I mean, you know, how about a war on lies? You know, it's impossible. It can't be done. So the whole thing is a smoke screen to begin with, and the result of everybody going along with this, oh, God, yeah, we're in war on terror, gave these people what they have been looking for. These people being the actual people involved and the descendants of the people who have been trying to turn this country into a fascist state for 100 years. I mean, you do know that, right? You do know that there have been very prominent American industrialists and political leaders and military leaders who wanted desperately to see the United States give up this crazy-ass democracy business, Democratic Republic business, you know, take the vote away from women, put the Negroes back in their place, throw all the immigrants out on their asses, you know, make it English only, you know, just on and on. You know what the agenda is. And it dovetails perfectly with the psychopathic, murderous religious right, Christian right in this country. So it's been going on for a long time. Cheney's involvement is certainly not a surprise. Now, the question was, why do they do it? I wish I had an answer. Wouldn't it be neat if we had an answer? Then we could make sure, by whatever means necessary, that it didn't happen again, right? Or something. I don't know. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
Obama wedding boy, you've been a naughty girl, you put your weapons down. bang, bang, bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk.
He's your nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Talk that talk. You knocks me out. Out off my
21 past the hour. All right, we finally, about an hour ago, we got our missive from Prairie 2. And the subject line is the Obama dollar bill. Prairie 2 writes, we've gotten some trickle down from the Bush crime family for the $80 billion in TARP money they handed out to the biggest banks. We got about $200 million in lending going. That's a penny for every $40 they handed out. That's a bigger trickle than we usually get. Estimates are out that the top 1,000 rich people in the world lost $2 trillion last year, and the number of billionaires declined by a third from the previous year. The head of the Blackstone Group estimates that 45% of the world's wealth is gone. Of course, that's just bat squeeze. The wealth he's talking about is just paper. They had stolen all the real wealth, and to make their package look bigger, they were just stuffing socks in their pants. Whoa. Of course, real wealth is disappearing. Real wealth. Foreclosed houses that are stripped of copper and eventually torn down. Cars that families are living in are rusting away. Factories that are closed will never reopen. Farmland has lost 10% of its value in the last 6 months, and that will cut available credit and end many of the family farms. Walmart continues to grow, and each new one ends 200 small businesses forever. Everywhere you look, this is going on faster and faster. Capitalism could be more accurately called financialism. Banking was 8% of the economy when Reagan took over. Just before this crash, it was 30%. A real sustainable economy would have very little banking activity. What Obama does with the banks will be the real test of his presidency. Andrew Jackson took the money supply away from the banks. Lincoln issued greenbacks rather than borrow money from the big banks. If Obama wants his picture on a United States note someday, he will have to fight and win the war with the Wall Street bankers. Pray too. You know, it's amazing to me. When I was a kid growing up, I used to hear my grandfather, who was an immigrant, and he had a tire store and gas station, and he made a lot of money in the stock market prior to the crash in 1929. He was not a very good English speaker, but he had trust in another man in this town, Findlay, Ohio, that showed him how to invest in the right kind of stuff. And in 1929, the stock market crash pretty much wiped out my grandfather's fortune. He had built it up to a substantial amount, according to my mother and my aunts. And then he just turned around and did it again. Only the second time he did it, he was a little bit more careful in how he built his second fortune. And as a kid growing up, when I finally came on the scene and got to know him in the 40s and 50s, I can remember When he was feeling expansive and wanted to sit around and talk after dinner, he would talk about, and he never cursed because he was, my grandmother had converted him to Protestantism, and he wound up in a Baptist church. But he used to say, "Those damn bankers. Those damn bankers." And I could never, I could never figure out. And if it was like a Sunday afternoon dinner, and my mother and my aunts and my uncles and my grandmother and everybody would be there for, you remember. You probably did it, your family, too. And everybody would be quiet and listen when Pop spoke. That's what they called him, Pop, Grandpa or Pop, when he spoke. And he spoke with a broken kind of English. He was not very good at sentence structure, but he could read the Wall Street Journal pretty damn well. But he used to talk about the damn bankers. And when he would use those two words, of course, my grandmother would get very upset because she didn't like cursing in her home, in her house. And my mother and her brothers and sister, my aunts and uncles, would kind of look around and you know, like, uh-oh, here goes Pop again. He's gonna get furious. And he would. He would get red in the face. I could never figure out what the hell, you know, what are you talking about? The damn bankers. Well, all of a sudden, here I am, 60 years later, all these years later, and it's still the damn bankers. Only now it's the goddamn bankers, which I'm sure my grandfather would have said, but out of respect for his wife, my grandmother, he didn't. But it's unbelievable, and what they have done, and the predatory practices, they continue. Don't you remember when was it? Several years back, when all of a sudden, if your account was overdrawn, and how many of us have not had our checking account overdrawn ever? Huh? Let me see. Any hands? No, of course not. Oh, Kathy. All right. You've never had your account overdrawn.
They made a mistake once, but they corrected it.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't my fault.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And I was 18.
You were 18. Well, I've had it happen to me, and most people have had it happen to them. And remember when they went from a $3 insufficient funds charge? Remember when it was $3? Some of you can remember when it was less than that, or zero. They would just call you up and say, get some money in here. But $3. And what is it now? I don't know. Somebody told me it's like $35 for an insufficient funds check. Goddamn bankers.
Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. The phone number here is 877-89-MALLOY. And after tonight, with the screw-up with AT&T, tomorrow night I think we'll have four lines that will work when you call in. As it's happening tonight, we just have one available line. So I would like to hear from you this last half hour if you want to keep trying to reach us. Now, the other thing from our military affairs correspondent, apparently, and this is from today, the military is giving conflicting stories on soldier suicides. No one likes to talk about this. We're not even allowed to see coffins coming home with the remains of the people who have died because our government sent them to die or to kill. I almost said died defending freedom. They haven't died defending freedom. And that's what just, it just smashes my heart to think that so many of these 19 and 20 and 21-year-olds really do believe that when they go through the training and put on the lethality that they're going to use against people and then get blown to pieces themselves, you know, the idea as they're walking to their own deaths that they're defending freedom. They're not defending freedom. If the only freedom they're defending, and this is a stretch, is the freedom for these predatory corporations and capitalists to continue to steal. Jesus Christ. I mean, this is not hard stuff, folks. This is not, and I don't care if you're a right-winger. You dumb bastard, wake up and smell the coffee. Do you honestly believe that the U.S. military over the past 60 years has been fighting for freedom? Freedom for whom? Come on, get real. The military has been abused and used, misused by the power, the political power, for a couple, three generations. And if you want to get really porky about it, let's go all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt and the Spanish-American War. But once again, I digress. Now the military is giving conflicting stories on soldier suicides. Last Thursday, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, General Peter Chiarelli, contradicted statements concerning Army suicides made 2 weeks earlier by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Michael Mullen. you know, the highest dude, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, had made a statement concerning suicides. What happened was in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, Admiral Mike Mullen told soldiers last week that it appears repeated long deployments in combat zones may be a factor in the increase in the number of suicides among soldiers. Admiral Mullen told about 680 soldiers at Fort Campbell during a town hall style meeting that soldiers are getting too little time at home after spending as much as 15 months in combat. Mullen said, "I can't believe that is not a huge factor." Now, there have been all sorts of studies about this, but here comes General Peter Chiarelli, who says he was answering questions during a bloggers' roundtable regarding the skyrocketing suicide rate in the Army, and this General Chiarelli said, quote, "Even when you take that number, the rational person might think that the more deployments, the more likely you are to commit suicide, but we saw exactly the opposite. A certain resiliency seems to grow in an individual who has multiple deployments, and we actually see the percentage of suicides for multiple deployers much smaller than for individuals who have had a single deployment." Well, that statement directly refutes what his commanding officer said in February. Mullen said it's a huge factor, multiple deployments. Now, oddly enough, or maybe not oddly, Chiarelli's suggestion also contradicts the findings of Army studies. Army studies completed in both 2007 and 2008. In 2007 report, it said, quote, "There was a significant relationship between suicide attempts and number of days deployed in Iraq, Afghanistan, or nearby countries where troops are participating in the war effort. The same pattern seemed to hold true for those who not only attempted but succeeded in killing themselves. There also was limited evidence to support the view that multiple deployments are a risk factor for suicide behaviors," end quote. And similarly, in a 2008 Army study, more deployments were tied to higher rates of PTSD, a chief factor in soldier suicides. This is from USA Today. From 15 to 20% of all soldiers fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan show signs of depression or PTSD, according to the study of almost 2,300 soldiers. That rate jumps to about 30% for soldiers who have been on three or four combat deployments. So why, and this is Brandon Friedman writing at vetvoice.com, Brandon Friedman, who is a combat veteran, why is General Chiarelli suddenly going against the grain, arguing that multiple deployments, in fact, cause a certain resiliency to grow in soldiers? I have no idea, Brandon writes, but General Chiarelli wasn't the only high-ranking Army official on the conference call attempting to downplay the role of several long deployments on the health of the force. Colonel Elspeth Ritchie, who is a doctor, was also on this blogger phone call, and she had this to say, quote, "The caveat is often when you look at these cases, there's a multitude of factors. There's both a relationship problem and a legal or an occupational problem, maybe a substance abuse problem, and sometimes it's hard to identify what was the actual precipitant." The actual precipitant? Come on. We're exposing troops to the most violence soldiers have seen since Vietnam in two simultaneous wars with an army that's too small, and we've lowered entrance standards to do it, and you don't know what the actual precipitant is for people who attempt suicide? So Brandon Friedman, writing at vetvoice.com, concludes by saying, "I'm not sure why General Chiarelli and Colonel Ritchie are intent on pushing this notion that the number and lengths of deployments aren't a major contributing cause of soldier suicides. Because this now sends a mixed signal to both the troops and their families at a time when government organizations need to be working cohesively to prevent soldier suicides. If the Army, as reflected in General Chiarelli's remarks, thinks more and longer deployments cut down on suicides, then that would necessitate an entirely different approach to the issue than if the Army saw multiple deployments as a significant contributing factor in soldier suicides. There would be no need for longer dwell times, that's time at home, and no need for a larger army. So, you can draw your own conclusions here, but when the actual numbers, the statistics and the actual numbers, forget the statistics, because as Mark Twain said, they're lies, damn lies, and statistics. So forget them. Take a look at the actual number of soldiers who are committing suicide or attempting suicide after multiple deployments. I've never heard of this. I have never, I'm sure it has happened, but I have never heard of a time in our history, especially now, when people who join the military are told, well, you're going to go to the combat zone and you'll be gone for 12, 14, 15 months. And when you come home, we're going to send you back within a month, and then we're going to send you back again, and then we're going to send you back again. Jesus God, what is that? And what does the Army or the Marine Corps expect when these people are finally cut loose? What do they expect? Somebody who has made, pick a number, 3 deployments to a combat zone, who has seen more violence and death in 14 months than you and I will see in 10 goddamn lifetimes. You know why? Because we don't participate in the military anymore. Remember, it's all volunteer. And what makes it easier for volunteers to join than a global recession like this one? But you and I don't have a clue. We don't know what these families are going through, and part of the reason is because we're not allowed to see soldiers coming home in caskets with flags draped. And you know why? Because then we might say, enough of this goddamn garbage. Stop it! As some of us have been saying for the past 7 years. Stop it. Bring them home.
What are you, some goddamn commie peacenik? They're out there fighting for freedom.
Does anybody really still believe that? You know, I hear these people get on television and talk about the glorious wonders of Iraq now, as though the deaths of almost 5,000 American military men and women and up to 1 million Iraqis justifies this puppet government that still can't even keep the goddamn lights on, but is busy negotiating oil recovery contracts with people like ExxonMobil. Will somebody please, do you suppose there'll ever be a time in your lifetime or my lifetime, and some of us don't have that much time left, where this kind of hog snot lies will stop? Where we'll have a military where they're not told, well, come on, boy, come on, young lady, come and join the military and fight for freedom. You suppose that'll ever happen?
Tomorrow, and I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very
before the hour. Thanks to our engineer, Kathy Bay, who got special assistance from Ian Huff. Our technical advisor is Ben Birch, military affairs correspondent Sharon Gordy. Economic advisor is Bruce Enberg, and the program's ethical consultants are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolfe. The executive producer is also Kathy Bay. And again, many thanks to Nancy and the really nice people at now800.com for getting us set up so quickly and cheaply today. We just about had, well, I should say Kathy just about had a nervous breakdown until these folks stepped in and handled our 800 service. You ought to go there, check out their website, support their service. They really saved our lives today, okay? Now800.com. From Steve the banker regarding war, call it a global depression, not recession, and it provides the meat for the meat grinders. Oh, God, yeah, isn't that the truth? And Reg writes, semantics matter. No country, no military from anywhere in the world can take away our freedom. They can attack us or kill some of our citizens, but they cannot, under any circumstances, take away our freedoms. The only people who can take away our freedoms are our elected leaders. No U.S. soldier is protecting our freedoms, not a single one, anywhere. Let's say it like it is. How long will that absurd mantra be repeated? Probably for as long as it's effective. And that's the part that, I mean, it really, really, really makes me angry. You know, it's like when you finally come out of the ether and you realize the extent of the lies. But I think the part that is almost unbearable for me is seeing the occasional video now, and they're very occasional, they're very rare, of the families gathered for the graveside services of a young man or woman who has been sent to Iraq or to Afghanistan or Pakistan, wherever we're waging war, and their bodies come back. There's a young wife and usually a young son or a young daughter, and they go through the ceremony. And then they present the tri-cornered flag, the folded flag, to the widow. It's usually the widow. It's usually a young woman. And the officer presenting the flag drops to a knee, looks her in the eye, and tells her how grateful the people of the United States and the United States military and the government of the United States for the sacrifice of her loved one. And I can't help but think to myself, you know, it's that officer trying to show a little compassion for this woman, but it's such a goddamn lie. It's such a horrifying, painful lie. And now this woman and her son or daughter will, these two kids or one kid or three kids will grow up without their father. For what? That's why it's almost unbearable for me. I mean, it really is. Don't you think? Stephen is calling from Burbank, listening on Sirius satellite radio. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, Mike. The question is, why do they have to be like that? The top rich, the big, the bullies and the warmongers and all that stuff.
Right.
And I think I may be wrong, but I believe it might be because they have their fear and they have their egos. And they have their Learjets, they have their 40-acre estates. I know of one guy that ran for president, has seven houses.
Yeah.
And they don't want to lose that. They don't want the competition. If the middle class is strong and they decide to share amongst themselves and go into business for themselves, it would be serious competition to them, and they would have to they'd have to sell, you know, all their big riches and stuff and live like the rest of us. And in order to help perpetuate that too, well, we have to pay money for the war. You know, we can't pay money for social programs. We can't pay money for that. Everything is for the war, as you know, by Lyndon Johnson, the Great Society, and then Vietnam. It's so simple. Anybody can see it. And here's another thing. The ego. When I talk to these right-wing people, I look them right in the eye and try to tell them where it's at. But their ego refuses to allow them to admit the truth. And that's it, because they don't want to admit that they were wrong. They're beating their chest, and all that other stuff. It gets kind of frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it sure does. I hear you. Stephen, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in, okay? Take care. Now, if you haven't had enough fun tonight, let me just quote couple of paragraphs here. Gary Young, writing at The Nation. It's in the context of a larger article, but he says social unrest is gaining pace. In December, the Kremlin flew riot police to Vladivostok to crush demonstrations against new taxes on imported cars. In February, the Elysee flew riot police to the French Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, where there has been a general strike for more than a month, with protesters demanding lower prices and higher wages. In February, 500,000 truckers brought Mexico's national highways to a halt, demanding lower diesel prices. Britain has seen wildcat strikes at oil refineries or the employment of foreign workers at lower wages. Latvia, Greece, Chile, and Iceland have all seen huge protests. For now, most of the action is not taking place on center stage, but it's only a matter of time before it spreads from the margins to the mainstream. That's us, right? The mainstream? All right, keep your chin up. Yeah, oh man. Yeah, you got to do that. We really do. We really do. We'll get through this. We'll get through this. I'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is, Mike Malloy.